We're celebrating the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln on Mid-Morning today. At 9, a historian whose family has been researching and writing about Lincoln for five generations. His new book is a terrific mix of history and photographs. At 10, Lincoln through the eyes of the modern politician. Stay with us. Mid-Morning begins in a moment. First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Obama returns to Illinois today to stump for the $790 billion economic stimulus plan. Congress could give the package of tax cuts and spending programs final approval by tomorrow. NPR's Giles Snyder reports.
President Obama is flying to Peoria as part of his effort to build support for the plan. He's to visit a factory operated by heavy equipment maker Caterpillar. The bill includes billions in spending on transportation infrastructure, which could help Caterpillar rehire some 22,000 recently laid off workers. The House could vote as early as today on the compromise plan. It was finalized after marathon talks between House and Senate negotiators. It also includes tax credits for individuals and families, aid for the unemployed, and assistance for those without health care. Passage would be an early legislative victory for President Obama, but instead of the bipartisan support he wanted, just a handful of Republicans are expected to vote for the measure. The bill had to be pared down at the insistence of moderate Senate Republicans, whose support is crucial. Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
The government reports retail sales rose by 1% in January. Most economists had expected another decline, and new figures show first-time claims for unemployment benefits dropped last week, but the numbers are still near a 26-year high. The Japanese electronics company Pioneer today announced it is cutting 10,000 jobs. NPR's Louisa Lim reports.
These are just the latest in a series of layoffs by Japan's corporate giants, struggling with the double blow of slumping demand and the stronger yen. Pioneer now estimates its annual losses will mount to a record $1.4 billion. It will cut 16% of its full-time workforce and pull out of the plasma screen market, closing two plasma screen assembly plants. One of those is in Pomona, California, the other in Britain. Both will be shut by April. The company already shed almost 6,000 jobs last year. Many Japanese companies are hurting badly. Sony's cutting 8,000 jobs, while Nissan and NEC are each laying off 20,000 workers. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
At least 181 people are now known dead after wildfires that started last weekend in southeastern Australia. Officials suspect arson may be involved in some of the fires. Detective Inspector Bob Sitlington says forensic teams are working long hours but are getting regular breaks.
What we try to do is rotate people, giving them about 4 days in the field, bring them back, and then put them out again.
Two men have been taken in for questioning, but police are not yet calling them suspects. The government reports businesses cut inventories 1.3% in December. That's the biggest reduction in 7 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial averages down 174 points, and the NASDAQ Composite is down 22. This is NPR News.
Support for news comes from Mini, with the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with front-wheel drive and dynamic stability control standard. Learn more at miniusa.com.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm William Wilcoxon. A Minnesota House committee is considering a proposal today that would require voters to show photo IDs before casting ballots. Republican Representative Tom Emmer says his bill would improve integrity in the electoral system. But Democratic Secretary of State Mark Ritchie says it would disenfranchise many voters, particularly senior citizens. Supporters of medical uses of marijuana are enlisting family members of those who have died in slow agony as they push state lawmakers to get a bill onto Governor Tim Pawlenty's desk during this legislative session. The bill took its first step yesterday when it was approved by a Senate committee on a divided vote following an emotional hearing. Fort Ripley Republican Paul Coring says he became a supporter after watching his mother die of cancer. Joni Whiting, who lost an adult daughter to cancer, broke down crying after reading a statement about the ordeal and the relief marijuana brought her daughter. A representative of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association raised concerns about potential abuses, and Governor Pawlenty says his longstanding opposition has not changed. Representatives of several Twin Cities social service agencies say they're seeing an increase in calls to crisis lines. Officials with the United Way say the recession has led more people to call its 211 information line looking for basic services such as food, clothing, and shelter. Calls have also increased to the Tubman Family Alliance, which operates several emergency shelters in the metro area. Martha Nagley says the shelters have seen a 20% increase in demand compared to last year.
Our biggest concern is that this demand for shelter services is going to continue to increase, which will put a serious strain on the statewide system that we have in order to address the needs of victims of domestic violence.
Nagley says the recession is making it harder for women to stay out of violent relationships. I'm William Wilcoxon, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Today's programming is supported by the Shakopee Mittauwakaton Sioux community, who have given more than $48 million in economic development grants to other tribes over the last 4 years. You can visit ShakopeeDakota.org for more information.
This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, 2 hours of Lincoln on his 200th birthday. Lincoln biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin has said that as she immersed herself in the revered president's life and prepared to write about him, she experienced a kind of transformation herself. The longer she lingered in Lincoln's world, the more she strived to become a better person. And maybe Kearns Goodwin, as she so often does, has put into words the reason why so many people yearn to embrace Lincoln's legacy. But that legacy, burnished by the mythologizing that began shortly after his assassination, is much more complicated than many Americans realize. Our guest, Philip Coonhart, wrote recently in Smithsonian Magazine, from the time of his death in 1865 to the 200th anniversary of his birth, February 12, 2009, there has never been a decade in which Abraham Lincoln's influence has not been felt. Yet it has not been a smooth unfolding history, but a jagged narrative filled with contention and revisionism. Today in our first hour, we're going to focus on that jagged narrative shaped by journalists and biographers, admirers and critics. In our second hour, a more contemporary view of the Lincoln legacy and how it may inform and influence our new president, who was, after all, sworn in just weeks ago on Lincoln's Bible. Indeed, on the night that President Barack Obama won the election, he quoted Lincoln to the crowds in Grant Park, saying, "We are not enemies but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection." That's our conversation at 10. But this hour, Philip Coonhart joins us. He's a Lincoln historian, writer, producer, and Bard Center fellow. He's part of a family that has been researching and publishing books about Lincoln going back five generations. And now he is also the author of a new book, along with Peter Coonhart and Peter Coonhart Jr., his brother and nephew, of Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. It's an exceptional mix of details and history, memories, long-forgotten stories about Lincoln with photographs that really bring the president and the people of his era alive. Philip Coonhart joins us this morning from Carnegie Hall Studios. And Philip, such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, Carrie, it's great to be with you on Lincoln's 200th birthday.
I know. That's quite a celebration, isn't it? I wonder if you've experienced the same thing that Doris Kearns Goodwin talks about, in that living with this president, it somehow changed you.
I think many of us feel that way, and Doris is a friend of mine, and I know she feels this way. And it's reminiscent of something that Ida Tarbell, once said about her relationship with Lincoln, that was that he could spend a lifetime with him and never get tired of him. And this is what we all find. It people keep asking why so many books on Lincoln, why so many authors are interested in this subject, and why doesn't it just go away? Well, it doesn't go away because he is just endlessly fascinating.
You know, given your family's association with him, five generations, and I want to hear about your great-great-grandfather here in just a minute, but I have to have believe that Lincoln has put a stamp on your family, too. Is that true?
Well, it's true. I mean, I didn't realize it growing up, but we were surrounded by his image. My father kept large photographs of Lincoln on walls of his living room. He had a large sculpture of a bronze cast sculpture of Lincoln by the stairway going up to our bedrooms. And, you know, and then my great grandfather was still alive in my childhood. He lived to age 96 and had his studios in New York City. And as boys, my brother and I used to go visit him in there. So we did realize more and more that we were in a special kind of family in which Lincoln played a very powerful role.
All right. So Frederick Hill Meserve, was he your great-grandfather or your great-great-grandfather? He knew
one
Lincoln,
great.
Right? Okay, one great.
He didn't know Lincoln. He was born the year Lincoln died.
I got it.
Interestingly, knowing him as I did, I felt that through that one man, I could reach back to the era of Lincoln, which made it not seem that long ago to me in some ways. His father knew Lincoln very little. His path crossed Lincoln's on a couple of occasions. He was an officer in the Union Army, wounded at Antietam, and fought under Ulysses S. Grant in the Wilderness Campaign. And interestingly, he was assigned to the military guards that were stationed in Washington, D.C. on the night of Lincoln's assassination.
Wow.
So he's the one who really began the interest in this subject. And he kept a diary and later turned it into a full memoir and asked his son, Frederick, to help him illustrate it. And that's where my great-grandfather began his lifelong quest for the photographic record of the 19th century.
The story of your great-grandfather searching out these photographs is so interesting. And this discovery that he makes at one point in a warehouse of all of these photographs, tell us about that.
That was the turning point in his life. He had actually begun this work in the 1890s, beginning by, haunting old bookstores and places where you'd find photographs. And he was already had the bug. He had caught the fever of interest. And one of the things he knew was that from his studies was that the famous photographer Matthew Brady had gone bankrupt late in his career, and that his great cache of Civil War era negatives had been given to his printer in lieu of debt. And that the printer had somehow, but nobody seemed to know what had happened to them. The printer, E&HT Anthony, had merged with a company called Scoville. They were the Anthony Scoville Company, ANSCO. And they had a warehouse in Hoboken, New Jersey. And he, as a detective, sniffed it out and found out that these glass negatives were still in one of those warehouses. And they were utterly neglected. They were lying in the corner of a kind of a dirty room covered with dust and grime, broken some of them, and he got permission to go in and examine them. And he discovered by lifting one up to the light that it was a life negative of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
And he made a bid on the entire lot of some 11,000 negatives and bought them that day. That was the beginning, really, that was the beginning of his great era of photographic scholarship.
Matthew Brady took some of the most iconic photographs of Lincoln, but I was very interested to read that Lincoln really understood the power of photography and ended up sitting for many, many photographic portraits.
He did. Photography had been around for a little bit. I mean, it was invented in the late 1830s, spread here from France. And during the 40s and 50s, presidents had been photographed before. I mean, I think James K. Polk was photographed with his cabinet in the East Room on the daguerreotype method. But, nobody had really had used it to promote their own image politically before Lincoln. And so he was lucky to coincide with some new technology in which negatives could make prints, could be used in newspapers for etchings, and that very quickly you could get your image disseminated. And he recognized the power of this medium, and he did use it to his advantage. He said that the Cooper Union portrait taken in New York City in 1860 helped elect him to the presidency.
Well, yeah, Philip, I was going to ask you, what do you think he understood about, in some ways, what he understood about celebrity, right, and the power of the image? And presidents have understood that from then on, haven't they? But what did Lincoln know about that?
Well, and he did understand this, and he understood that if you could forge a sense of a personal connection with the American public, that you could exercise your powers of persuasion and reach goals that might not otherwise be possible. He did this not only through imagery, but he did it also through words, of course. We could talk more about that. Mm-hmm. But he felt that if his picture were in people's parlors, as they were, and people would collect what was called carte de visite images. These were little calling cards with your photograph on it. And people had albums in their parlors where they would place these things. And so you could come in and look at each other's albums, and you could see Abraham Lincoln in your home. And I think the sense of personal connection with the president was a new thing.
Is it, Philip, is it Gardner that took the famous cracked plate photograph of Lincoln? I think I saw it last year when I was in Washington. Isn't it in the archives?
It's now owned. It's one of the great treasures of the National Portrait Gallery, which is part of the Smithsonian Institute. And it once belonged to my great-grandfather.
Wow.
I can tell you a little bit about that image because it's very important to our family legacy. This was Alexander Gardner worked for Matthew Brady, and he ran his Washington studios, and then at a certain point broke free and opened his own business and became the other great photographer of Lincoln. And this particular photograph that you mentioned was taken in 1865. It was one of the last pictures of Lincoln ever taken. And there's so much in it. It's a large glass plate image that was taken close up to his face, signs of the aging process in the face that the presidency had put him through, a little bit of a glimmer of peace coming through in his expression as the war was beginning to wind down. It just communicates so much, that image. Unfortunately, Gardner cracked the plate in the processing of it and just decided to piece it together and make one single print. And then he discarded the glass. So that one print later was sold to a Massachusetts collector named Truman Bartlett. And my great-grandfather sought him out and purchased it from him. And he considered it his greatest possession. He really did.
And Phil,
it was the single print made from that negative.
And there is something about the crack in that photograph I think in some ways symbolizes the tragedy of Lincoln's life cut so short. Am I being too dramatic, or do you see the same?
Well, I have a similar poetic feeling about it myself. I mean, some people have pointed to the fact that the crack runs in an almost identical trajectory to Booth's bullet, which I think goes a little too far. But I think the sense of the tragedy of losing Lincoln when we did, just as the war was closing down, when the North was beginning to celebrate finally, and when there was so much hope for the way the nation might be put back together, this genius who had presided over those years was taken from us.
Philip Coonhart is with us this morning. He's a writer, producer, and historian out with a terrific new book, along with Peter Coonhart and Peter Coonhart Jr., his brother and nephew. It's called Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Now, if you think you have read everything there is to read about Lincoln, this book is unique. It's a combination of some of these amazing treasures of photographs. Some photographs, some of them are of course iconic and you've seen them before, but some of them, I would venture to say, you probably have not seen, from the era as well as from the life of President Abraham Lincoln, and a lot of historical detail about the immediate aftermath of the assassination, the mythologizing that went on shortly after. We're going to talk about that today as well. And then how Lincoln's life and tenure as president really changed the culture of the era that would follow. If you'd like to join our conversation this hour, by the way, 2 hours of Lincoln, because we are celebrating a big birthday here, the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Next hour, we'll talk about Lincoln through the eyes of modern politicians. But this hour, the history and the legacy. 800-242-2828. If you'd like to join our conversation in the Metro, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651 227-6000 online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. If you'd like to get a look at a Matthew Brady photograph of Lincoln from the Meserve Coonhart collection, you can find it on the mid-morning page. Philip, you say something very interesting in the preface of the book about Lincoln. You wrote, Lincoln saw the past as a living reality. I puzzled over that. What does that mean?
Well, what I meant by that is that, in a sense, the past is not dead as long as it lives on in the minds of those of us today. The poet Keats talked about this. He talked about how you can actually discover friends in former eras, kind of almost like soulmates, that you can feel more connected to somebody who lived long ago than you might even feel connected to somebody alive today. And this is a kind of a mystery of time that Lincoln contemplated. In his regard, he felt very deeply connected to the era of the founders and their vision for this country, and that influenced him. I mean, he had a tremendous sense of time, and I ponder this often, not only in this book, but in the rest of my life. I mean, he had a sense of the past, he had a sense of the great future ahead of us, and he had a sense of the present as that fulcrum in which the future was being invented.
So how did that shape the decision making that he was doing, or the way he saw the breadth of his presidency? Not to know, of course, that it would be cut short, but how did he view that?
Well, I believe you have to remember, Lincoln is often called a centrist. I'm not sure if that's meant as a compliment or not. I see him inhabiting something I call the radical middle. He was able to accomplish things that people on the far to his left front or his right flank I don't think could have, but he was heavily criticized as president for being too slow. For example, radicals and people to his left thought he was too slow to declare emancipation, mm-hmm. that he wasn't adequately committed to black freedom or equality, and he was heavily criticized. He was also deeply feared by those to the right of him who suspected that he was more radical than he led on. But what he was, in fact, was biding his time. And I think this had something to do with his sense of unfolding history. If you move too quickly, you can blow your opportunities. I mean, he had to be very careful that the border states, for example, didn't peel off and join the Confederacy. So therefore, his Emancipation Proclamation, when it came out, did not apply to the border states. He thought this they had not joined the rebellion and they shouldn't be punished in that way. And nor did he feel he had the constitutional authority to do so. But it was a question of biding his time, waiting for the right opportunities, being willing to be criticized by those maybe out in front than he was. But when the time comes, pouncing. And that's how he understood history. I think he understood it almost, I sometimes think about him as a river pilot, which he was in his young days. He drove a flatboat to New Orleans from Illinois on two occasions. And, he learned how to negotiate the river. Sometimes it moves slowly. Sometimes you hit a whitewater in rapids, and all your attention has to come into play. And I think he saw the Civil War as a kind of whitewater. And he had to be very awake, and lest he pile the nation up on the rocks. Those are some of the things I think he thought about in terms of time and history.
I want to believe that all of our presidents have that sense of history, but I think that's fairly, what I do today will have consequences perhaps for 40 or 50 or 100 years hence. But I think it's an unusual gift to get mm-hmm. that right. Do you think Lincoln usually got it right?
Well, I don't think he was perfect. I think he made some mistakes, and I don't think it serves him his memory well to think he was perfect. I think he, in some regards, in terms of his vision for a truly interracial future for this country, he was slow to get that. And it took him time. I think he was getting there, and I think he got there, but when he was by the time he was killed, and his whole movement was in the correct direction, but I do think he did take the long view when he looked at American history. He was he saw that he called this country the last best hope of earth. He saw the Republican kind of government as being tested by the war, and if it were to be to go down, the world would be much poorer for it. And so he saw this as a very, very important test.
Let's take some calls. 800-242-2828 to join us this morning in the Metro 651-227-6000. And if you're listening online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Rolf in Apple Valley. Hi, you're on Mid-Morning.
Hi. Growing up, my dad was a politician in Minnesota, and he'd take our family on pilgrimages to the Lincoln sites. And one of the things that really struck me was he had so limited educational opportunity, and just the mastery of the English language is something that blows me away about what he was as a person and a president. Any comment on his kind of self-education and the power of his writing?
Philip.
Hi, Rolf. Yeah, that's a great question. It's amazing that Lincoln had less than 1 year of formal education and at the very elementary levels. He was entirely self-educated, and he did it all through reading. He was a fanatic for borrowing books, for finding any sources that he could. He didn't have many. One of the few books he had in the early years was the Bible, and he read it, you know, from front to cover many times, immersing himself in that the cadences of the King James English. So yes, he is. You have to wonder how he became so eloquent and such a master user of words. And there is a mystery there that has something to do with just who he was, as his given constellation of talents that he was born with, and that he then, through his own efforts, developed into the full flower that they became.
I have to say I appreciated the reprint of Lincoln's, the few pages of Lincoln's autobiography that he wrote in 1859. It was discovered after the Great Chicago Fire. And he writes about education. This is just great. He writes, "If a straggler supposed to understand Latin happened to sojourn in the neighborhood, he was looked upon as a wizard. There was absolutely nothing to excite ambition for education." I mean, he was chafing against the fact that he lived in a rural area, yeah. And it sounds like, and did not have access to real formal education.
And he also had a father who didn't really value this. In fact, he thought it was a waste of time. He would find Lincoln reading a book when he thought he should be working, and he'd hit him, he'd knock him down. And he told him that nothing would ever good would come of him if he didn't break himself of that habit. And so he had a very difficult home situation. He was very lucky after the death of his mother that his father remarried and did so to a very kindly woman who became his early ally and supported him in his intellectual pursuits. And so to the end of his life, he adored his mother, his stepmother, but he had a very ambivalent relationship with his father.
To the phones to Gordon in Shoreview. Hi, Gordon.
Yeah, hi, Carrie. The question I have is, when Lincoln said that we were the last best hope of mankind, what caused him to say that? Did he believe that we really were the last best hope of humankind, or did he use that as a kind of unifying sense of pride to bring the nation together in a dark time?
Philip?
Well, I don't have a whole lot to say about that. I think both are probably true. I think he did use language to inspire patriotism, to inspire commitment to a very difficult war effort that must have been, you know, that people, you know, at times wanted to flee from, no matter what the cost. But I also think he did have a deep belief in our American style of representative democracy. And he saw that it was, you know, other attempts to forge this kind of self-government had failed historically around the world, and that the whole world, in a sense, was looking to see whether this might be able to succeed or whether the Civil War would end it. And so I think both are true.
I was reading what Adam Gopnik wrote recently in The New Yorker about Lincoln, and his theory is that this nobility, I guess that so many people respond to, that Lincoln possessed, comes from this sense, this tragic sense of responsibility. He says that Lincoln's spiritual state at the end of the Civil War was similar to a Shakespearean tragic hero, resigned to a deadly fate that he did not will but would not avoid. Is that part of the constellation of qualities that Lincoln possessed that is the reason that so many different kinds of people respond to him in so many different ways?
Well, I think that's really well said by Adam Gopnik. There's a mysterious dimension to Lincoln that, you know, you could peel back the layers and you just don't ever seem to get to the bottom. In part, this is because he held his inner self close to himself. He was not entirely self-revealing. I do think he, you know, there's a sense toward the end that he felt that he had indeed finally attained his life's purpose. And that not only with the Emancipation Proclamation, which began the movement, but in particular with the passage of the 13th Amendment in 1865, which he had labored very hard to see passed, and to which he affixed his signature, something not called for by the Constitution, and which he called a king's cure for all the evil. I think following this, he felt, in a sense, that he had his life work had been done, and really he not that he wanted to die, I don't think he did, though he took great liberties with his safety. He did not like the guards that the War Department put on him. He was constantly sneaking out of the White House on his own to get some breath of fresh air alone, and he put himself at risk by going to the theater on the night of April 14th, against the wishes of Edwin Stanton, his Secretary of War. So there is a kind of, I wouldn't call it recklessness, but there's a sense that, you know, he's going to take whatever fate dishes up to him. And I do think this is part of the tragic dimension of his story.
Your book goes into a lot of interesting detail about the hours and the days and the weeks after the assassination. You write in the book that on Easter Sunday of Lincoln's death, he died, what, early Saturday morning?
Yes, 7:22 in the morning.
So by...
He was shot on Good Friday.
Okay. So by Easter Sunday, the preachers who are going to ascend to the pulpits in their churches know that they're going to have to speak about Lincoln. And you say it was on this day that Lincoln's reputation was established as one of the country's greatest secular saints and evermore as the nation's savior. Why?
Well, you can read this, the sermons. They've been collected from that era and published in books and actually on the web, and they're fascinating to see what the preachers of this country said. And it wasn't just the Protestant preachers, it was some Catholic preachers, and it was also in the synagogues as well, rabbis speaking about this. But in particular, Christian preachers who saw this assassination occurring on Good Friday, which is the anniversary of the crucifixion, and then had to preach about it on Easter Sunday, they made parallels. They said just as Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world, so has Abraham Lincoln been a martyr for the sins of the nation. He became a kind of secular Christ figure in their preaching. And they didn't see this as blasphemy. They saw it as just the truth. And you could see it repeated over and over and over again in these sermons. And I think it did help establish a mythological dimension to the death right away.
So preachers are putting their stamp on the history of Lincoln very quickly. What happens in the country? Because journalists begin to write about Lincoln as well pretty quickly too.
They did, and I just should mention the rabbis as well, because they of course, were not comparing the death to a crucifixion, but they were they were comparing Lincoln to Moses in their sermons, you know, who had led the people out of slavery into the promised land. And Lincoln was a new Moses figure for them. But journalists as well were writing. Preachers like Henry Ward Beecher, of course, had a journalistic quality to his ministry. But you could read in all of the magazines of the day had extensive editorials in which Lincoln was compared to George Washington, for example. As Washington was the father of the nation, Lincoln was its savior. And even his critics in the North, and he did have many critics, you remember. He was a minority elected president with only 39% of the vote. And he had a large Democratic opposition during the war. But even they were silenced after the assassination. It's like everybody came round to mourn his loss.
And what happens in the South?
In the South, of course, it's a different story. I mean, how could it be otherwise? This is the man who had presided over the commander-in-chief of the Union armies, who had ravaged through the land, had destroyed their way of life, had presided over the end of slavery, and who had sent Sherman, Mark, burning his way through Georgia. And he was largely hated still at this time. And that's not universally true. Robert E. Lee said that he thought the worst thing that ever happened to the South happened with the assassination. And there were many that shed tears for his family at this terrible loss. But there, you can also go to newspapers and diaries and other sources, and you could find a kind of almost a celebration in the death of the tyrant. And John Wilkes Booth is remembered as a kind of Brutus bringing down the tyrannical Caesar. So very, very different appropriation of Lincoln in the South.
To the phones to John in Minneapolis. And John, thanks very much for waiting. Your question for
Phil. Yes, good morning. And I have your coffee book on Lincoln and Mr. Quinn and Pledge talking. What would the country have been like if Lincoln had lived? Would there have been less of the Ku Klux Klan or less of the Reconstruction? I mean, or would there have been more success of the Reconstruction? Would there have been less of Jim Crow laws? Or what would the country have been like if Lincoln had lived?
Thank you, John.
Well, we don't know for sure, but I would say that Reconstruction would have unfolded more smoothly. It turned into a debacle. Andrew Johnson's was a very poor successor to Abraham Lincoln, and was soon at war with Congress over Reconstruction. And the people that took over Reconstruction, some of them lacked Lincoln's sensibilities. You remember his second inaugural address, in which he said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all." Lincoln had a deep desire to heal the breach between North and South, but without compromising on slavery. And I expect that he would have presided over Reconstruction with a similar mix of sensibilities, and I think things would have gone better. Now, I'm not saying that there would have been no Ku Klux Klan. I'm not saying there would have been no Jim Crow. Human nature is what it is, and these are large social forces, and one president cannot change all of history. But I do think we lost a lot when we lost Lincoln in terms of the way Reconstruction unfolded.
And why do you believe, as others do as well, that a healing between the races would have happened more quickly had Lincoln lived?
Well, Andrew Johnson was a thoroughgoing racist, and he was not at all interested in the healing of the races. That was just not his interest. It hadn't really been Lincoln's either. Lincoln was deeply opposed to slavery during his pre-presidential career. There's no question about it. He hated slavery. But he didn't have a vision for the equality of the races until midway through his presidency. It starts to become clear that he's beginning to see that the future is going to be an interracial one. So I think that, Lincoln and Johnson are two extremely different people. Lincoln was growing, and I think he would have continued to grow in the last 4 years of his presidency. And that's why I have confidence that Reconstruction would have begun in, on better legs.
If you just joined us this morning on Mid-Morning, Philip Coonhart is our guest. He's a writer, producer, historian, and co-author of a new book called Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. We're spending 2 hours this morning on Mid-Morning. Yes, 2 hours on the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln. This hour, the history, the legacy, the way Lincoln influenced the generation that would follow his presidency. Next hour, the modern Lincoln and how he influences and changes and affects politicians today, and why so many politicians want to grasp some of that Lincoln luster. That's at 10. 800-242-2828 to join us this hour. If you're in the Metro, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I was wondering if you could speak to a couple of things that we don't know about Lincoln. One is, are there any photographs that exist of him? I know that he had a great sense of humor. Are there any photographs that show his more animated side because of the limitations of photography and the length of exposure and things like that? Mm. Are they all stoic images? And do we have any idea of what his voice sounded like?
Oh, good question.
Oh, great, Joe. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Photography was still primitive. There was the more fast action working cameras were still in the future, though you'd begun to see that technology being used in stereographic images, which could freeze action on a city street, for example. And we see some of those beginning in the late 1850s. But in general, a studio portrait, the victim, as Lincoln liked to call himself, had to be placed in a chair and then his head locked into a head clamp. And then he was told to remain extremely quiet. He would actually try to crack jokes at this time because he loved to joke about his ugly face and how it would crack the lens of the camera and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, most of the images are kind of, I don't know if stoic, but they are, you know, they don't show the animated qualities that made his face so memorable to people of his time. There are a couple that hint at this smile, and I think that we talked earlier about the cracked Gardner print, but in that same sitting, several other images were taken of Lincoln in February 1865, and one of them, he has a distinctive smile on his face, his eyebrow is arched, his eyes are glistening, and he looks very, very alive, and you sense almost a sense of relief. The picture was taken right around the time of the passage of the 13th Amendment, and I think that some of the relief that came from that is evident in the face. So that's that. I guess that's what I'd have to say about the pictures. We don't have too many pictures showing him in that animated state, though if you look at all 114 of them that we have collected in the back of Looking for Lincoln, you'll actually see an amazing variety. He's almost a chameleon-like face. Sometimes he looks kind of goofy, and other times he has a kind of almost like this mule-like face, this stubbornness that comes through. Other times, later on, when the pictures are taken close to great events, such as the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln was photographed just prior to giving to that great event in his life. And there's almost a spiritual quality that comes through the image. And so it's fascinating to study his face. But, you know, the second question you asked was about his voice. And what I understand is that his voice actually was a very, very high tenor voice, which you might not expect when thinking about him. And it could be almost on the squeaky end of things. But he could project that voice over immense crowds, as he did often during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He could stand a crowd of thousands of people and be heard in the very back of the crowd. And this is partly because that high-pitched voice could travel over space. And he used it very effectively.
You know, that description of his voice just does not fit with his bearing and... You know, the way the expressions on his face and the fact that he was so tall. I think of him as having this deep booming voice. Not the case.
You know, I agree. And I'm just telling you what I've read. But when we did a program years ago on Abraham Lincoln, back in the early 90s, that I worked on very closely, we actually chose the actor Jason Robards to voice Lincoln.
Yeah.
And Jason Robards was great in that role, and but he has a baritone voice, quite a deep voice. And if you use that, the high-pitched voice doesn't seem to communicate the gravitas that we associate with Lincoln. And so somehow we took some poetic license and chose a different. And of course, Lincoln's voice would have had a very Illinois twang to it. His pronunciation of words would have been kind of odd to a modern ear. And so we took liberties with that as well. Because if you make him just in a kind of a quaint, literal rendition of his voice, I don't think he was going to communicate to us the way he was able to communicate to the people of his own day.
Online here from Pat in St. Paul, she writes, he was self-deprecating and a genius at disarming enemies. Accused of being a two-faced politician, he said, if I had another face, do you think I'd wear this one? That's an effective quality for a politician, isn't it, to be self-deprecating? We all like that for some reason.
We do, and he used humor very effectively. I think of instances where critics would come to him in the White House, and you had great. The public had extraordinary access to the president in those days. Anybody could go to the White House and be met at the door by a single doorman, and then take a little ticket and go upstairs and wait in a waiting room, and take their turn and eventually have a few minutes with the president.
It's amazing.
That was all there was to it. And people, sometimes his critics would come to blast him on something or other, and they'd go in there, and before you know it, he's telling you a story, and he's getting you laughing, and he's walking you toward the door and slapping you on the back, and suddenly you're out in the hallway again, and you hadn't even brought up what you came to talk about, but he bamboozled you with his humor. And he used it to disarm critics, and he often used it, as you say, in a self-deprecating sense, which is a good form of humor because it doesn't hurt other people.
Right.
And he did have a sensitivity about that. He did not want to hurt others.
To Nancy in St. Paul. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Your question for Philip.
Well, I had a high school teacher who was and very interested in the Civil War, and he had taught us, and it's probably the only thing I remember from high school history, that when Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, when he said, of the people, by the people, and for the people, he put the emphasis on people rather than by, of, and for, like you hear it quoted, which I think gave it a much different and more meaningful interpretation. And I noticed that Tom Hanks did it that way at the concert they had right before the inauguration.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, does that, Philip, do you think that changes the message of the Gettysburg Address?
Well, I think I kind of agree with the caller and with her teacher that his emphasis may well have been on the word people when he gave the address, though there are conflicting reports about, different. It's interesting. Eyewitnesses always have to be compared with one another, and in the end, you have to make some choices of what you think the actual event as it took place was. But Lincoln had a tremendous belief in the people, and this is partly why he was not willing to just go way out in front of public opinion and do things that the majority of the people who had elected him would disapprove of. This is, for example, he could not embrace the agenda of the radical abolitionists because they, for one, thought the Constitution should be burned because it was an evil compromise with slavery. He believed that you make change from within the system and that as a leader, your job is to bring the people along with you and to not just reflect their wishes, because that's not leadership, but not to get so far out ahead of the people that you become isolated from them. Which is why he kept his office hours open to the public, why he insisted that people have the right to access his office in this sometimes exhausting for him way. And it's why he gave addresses like at Gettysburg. It's why he sent public letters out throughout his presidency to make contact with the people and to influence their opinion and to bring them behind him, so that when he did make his great moves for emancipation and for in the war, that he would have a large group of people supporting him.
You know, it's
so
interesting.
Of the people, for the people, by the people, yes.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, though, and that he did not believe that you got too far out beyond public opinion, because I think in some ways we tend to believe that, you know, political courageousness is having the ability to say the people are not yet with me, but I see the path.
Yes.
And it's my responsibility to lead us on that path.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think Lincoln fits within that understanding of leadership. But the problem is if you hold to that very stubbornly and you get way out on your own, you can fail in your leadership task, because it's a kind of a you're all alone out there. You can't make change without a large group of people helping you. And the way you do that in the presidency is through the power of persuasion, as Richard Neustadt taught us. And you don't have you're not like a general of an army that you can bark orders at people and they'll jump too. You have to bring people along through persuasion. And so, you know, you can't get too far out ahead. You'd have to be ahead. I'm not saying you should just take public opinion polls and do whatever the public wants. That's not leadership. But you have to somehow be in dialogue with the public. You have to understand their fears. You have to understand their criticisms. You have to answer them clearly and rationally. And you have to inspire people with a vision that they're willing to follow you in.
We have an online comment here from Terry in Eagan, who writes that Lincoln apparently was personally shocked and mortified by the sheer number of deaths during the Civil War. Did this have an effect as time went on? Do we get that from letters and from photographs and from Lincoln's own writing?
Well, I do think this is probably one of the most difficult burdens he had to carry, was the knowledge that he was sending young men to their deaths in huge numbers. I mean, the carnage of the war. When you both North and South, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dead and wounded, is just more than any president could bear, I think. And he was reported to be some nights unable to sleep, walking the floors of the White House just with dark circles under his eyes, agonizing about this. So I think it did take a huge toll on him. How he coped is a good question. I think he was able to keep his sanity through his humor. He did believe that there was a great cause, that this war was being fought for, that there was a great cost to losing it, both for American democracy and also for, increasingly, for the plight of the slaves themselves. And he felt that the war had been brought upon him by the Confederates, and that he was not going to surrender and compromise. He was going to fight through to the finish.
Philip, we're going to talk about the modern Lincoln and why politicians want to grab on to some of his legacy at 10 o'clock. But as you know, Barack Obama is very interested in Lincoln, has read quite a bit about him, and considers him a historical mentor. So if President Obama were to ask you how to lead like Lincoln, what would you tell him?
Wouldn't I love it if he did ask me? I mean, I still have not met our president, but I am a great admirer of his. You know, I think he knows already the answer to that question, but I think some of the things we were talking about, leadership, would apply to him too. I think he also inhabits this middle ground where he's interested in bringing people together, where he's interested in staying in touch with the public and bringing them along. And I think he also understands the sense of waiting. You can't do everything at once. Some things you have to move quickly on. Other things take patience. I think also Lincoln's uncanny ability with words is something that Barack Obama already shares. but which he should use his words very carefully. Don't talk too much, but say, wait for the right opportunities, and then use the power of eloquence to persuade people to follow him. All those things are already in the works. The one difference between the two of them is that Barack Obama comes into the presidency with a great support of the American people. Lincoln did not. He came in with very minority support, and was largely, I don't want to say hated, but he had a huge amount of criticism against him throughout his presidency, and only slowly toward the end began to earn the love and veneration of the public. So Barack Obama needs to realize this is a long haul. He may go through some bad times, but if he keeps his integrity and keeps his vision and his desire to do good for the common cause, he will earn a more lasting form of respect.
Philip Kuhnhart, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Lincoln's 200th birthday. We appreciate it.
That's all we got. Great.
That's it. Thank you.
I wish there was more.
Philip Kuhnhart is a historian, writer, producer, and his book is called Looking for Lincoln. Here's a campaign song from the year 1860 called Lincoln and Liberty.
Great Reformation for Lincoln and Liberty too. We'll go for the boy from Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through. The pride of the sucker, so lucky, for Lincoln and Liberty too. Our David's good sling is unerring, the slavocrat giant he slew. So shout if you're freedom preferring, for Lincoln and Liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero the Hoosierdom through. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and Liberty too. Felling and mauling, a rail-splitting statesman can do. The people are everywhere calling for Lincoln and Liberty too. And up with our banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. We'll fight till our cause is victorious.
That's Lincoln and Liberty, performed by Oscar Brand. It's a campaign song from 1860. And Philip Kuhnhart's book is featured on the Mid-Morning book page. How do you find that? Look on the Made Mid-Morning page. You'll see a link that says What Carrie's Reading. I'll take you right to the page where you will find news about Gwen Ifill's new book, Breakthrough. She is with us on Monday. Exclusive online chat for KM Book Club members. This has been Morning.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor. March 21st, a Prairie Home Companion goes across the river to the State Theater on Hennepin Avenue, downtown Minneapolis. Live broadcast, Guy Noir, our radio actors, the Shoe Band, and of course, the news from Lake Wobegon. Tickets are available now at Ticketmaster.com or at the State Theater box office. Hope to see you there.
Programming is supported by the Minnesota State Colleges and University System, providing customized training for 6,000 Minnesota employers. We educate Minnesota. We make it work. Online at mnscu.edu.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.